From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Interrupting newscasts, halting trading at the New York Stock Exchange, occupying Grand Central Station at rush hour. 20 years of activism around AIDS. Today on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge yesterday refused to grant Timothy McVeigh a stay of execution, concluding that newly discovered FBI documents would have had no impact on McVeigh's 1997 conviction and death sentence for the Oklahoma City bombing. McVeigh's lawyers said they plan to appeal to the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals today and, if necessary, the Supreme Court. McVeigh is scheduled to die Monday at the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana. In related news, ahead of the scheduled executions of Timothy McVeigh and Juan Raúl Garza, Attorney General John Ashcroft said yesterday a new Justice Department analysis found no evidence of racial bias in the federal death penalty system. Ashcroft said he found no racial bias despite a study that African Americans, Latinos, and other minorities were considered for the federal death penalty more often than whites, accounting for about 80% of such cases since 1995. Ashcroft maintained that Black and Latino defendants were in fact less likely to be subjected to the death penalty at each stage of the Justice Department review process than white defendants. Ashcroft's testimony occurred just 2 days after a group of political, religious, and civil rights leaders appealed to Bush to declare a moratorium on all federal executions. A Los Angeles jury yesterday ordered Philip Morris companies to pay $3 billion in punitive damages to a 56-year-old smoker with cigarette-caused lung cancer, by far the largest damage award ever in a single cigarette case and possibly the largest ever for an individual suing a U.S. corporation. The state jury, which ruled against Philip Morris on 6 counts of fraud, negligence, and making a defective product, rejected company arguments that Richard Boken had freely chosen to smoke. Boken said he started smoking at 13 before warnings went on cigarette packs and, despite attempts, was unable to stop his 2-pack-a-day habit for 40 years. Company officials said the award was not rational and vowed an appeal. The decision is the latest in a pattern of escalating and enormous judgments against the tobacco industry. Relatives of a man who killed himself and 3 family members after taking the drug Paxil were awarded $8 million in damages yesterday. Jurors returned the verdict in a civil wrongful death suit against SmithKline Beecham, the manufacturer of Paxil, the country's second-largest selling antidepressant. The company is now called GlaxoSmithKline PLC. Relatives of Donald Schell claim he took 2 Paxil tablets before shooting to death his wife, their daughter, granddaughter, and himself February 13, 1998. GlaxoSmithKline attorneys say the pharmaceutical group will appeal the verdict. Democrats took full control of the Senate yesterday as the new majority leader, Tom Daschle, called for principled compromise in a spirit of bipartisanship to avoid gridlock in a Capitol where Republicans no longer hold all the levers of power. Democrats have said they would challenge much of the Bush administration's conservative agenda and advance their own priorities on patients' rights, education, and the environment. But Daschle repeated his assurances to Republicans yesterday that Democrats would not seek to block the Bush administration's judicial nominees, suggesting that he would consider taking judicial nominees to a floor vote even if they failed to make it out of the now Democrat-controlled Senate Judiciary Committee. Daschle also made a point yesterday of saying that Republicans would not face any obstacles from Democrats in offering amendments to legislation on the Senate floor, an opportunity they say was denied to them while Trent Lott was majority leader. The Pfizer pharmaceutical company announced yesterday it will offer the governments of more than 50 of the world's poorest countries an unlimited free supply of a powerful drug to combat fungal infections associated with AIDS. Pfizer's plan follows a round of price reductions by pharmaceutical companies and antiretroviral AIDS drugs. The price reductions were the result of widespread international pressure and legal action by African governments to suspend patent protection on expensive AIDS drugs in order to secure cheaper generic alternatives. But Henry McKinnell, Pfizer's chair and CEO, acknowledged the company is intent on keeping its market share even after its patents on the drugs expire in 2004. Pfizer's announcement was guardedly welcomed by some AIDS groups, but critics charge that the real purpose behind the drug corporation's move is to boost its public image and head off the introduction of generic drugs, which might cut into the market share of giant drug companies in the more lucrative markets of the U.S., Europe, and other developed countries. Paul Zeitz, a physician and epidemiologist with 12 years of work on AIDS in Africa, described Pfizer's action as a strategy to block access to generically manufactured drugs.
I don't know how my father stood his ground. I don't know how my people survived slavery. I do remember that's why I believe. I don't know why.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, I Remember, I Believe, here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. 20 years ago this week, the Center for Disease Control's newsletter reported 5 unrelated cases of pneumonia in homosexual men in the Los Angeles area. 2 of them had already died. The report generated little interest. As the death toll mounted and people with AIDS lost friend after friend, they found themselves up against incredible odds. A government that refused to acknowledge the disease, the Surgeon General under Reagan said the White House had prevented him from making any public statements on AIDS for the first 3 years of the epidemic. The president, Reagan, wouldn't even say the words AIDS publicly for years. Government bureaucrats who wouldn't approve drugs fast enough. Right-wing leaders who call the disease God's revenge on gays. Brutal homophobic police who wore gloves while beating up activists. A media more concerned about convincing the public that Saddam Hussein should be punished than about deaths at home. And a homophobic general population who stood by watching. But the incredible odds bred incredible results. AIDS activists conceived and carried out some of the most disruptive and effective actions in U.S. history. A few examples. October 11, 1988, the newly formed AIDS Action Group, ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, shuts down the FDA in Washington. September 14, 1989, ACT UP members infiltrate the New York Stock Exchange, staging a demonstration on the floor and slowing trading for the first time in history. The activists demanded that traders sell stock in Burroughs Wellcome, now Glaxo Wellcome, was the only maker of AZT and charged exorbitant prices. January 22, 1991, ACT UP members make it onto the set of the CBS Evening News, interrupting Dan Rather and the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour. Today, we're going to devote the hour to AIDS activism in this country over the past 20 years. We start with that CBS Evening Newscast on January 22, 1991.
CBS Evening News. Dan Rather reporting. Good evening.
Fight AIDS, not Arab.
We're going to take a break for a commercial just now.
Fight AIDS, not Arab.
We'll break for a commercial. Thank you very much.
They fade to black after you saw a little head pop up next to Dan Rather, and then it continues.
We're sorry about that.
had a bit of an eruption here in the broadcast. We're going to take things right from the top.
Uninvited guests who barged in on Dan Rather's newscast.
We're sorry about that. Had a bit of...
Investors made the news at Dan Rather's expense.
CBS Evening News surprised Dan Rather and everyone else. Just as the program was starting, three members of the AIDS activist group ACT UP disrupted things. Eric Shawn reports.
This is the CBS Evening News. Dan Rather reporting. Good evening.
Fight AIDS, not Arab.
We're going to take a break for a commercial just now.
Fight AIDS, not Arab.
It was a surprising beginning for Dan Rather's coverage of the Persian Gulf War. As the CBS News started, chanting AIDS activists disrupted the newscast as a protest against the fighting.
Fight AIDS, not Arab.
We're going to take a break for a commercial just now.
Several members of ACT UP, an anti-AIDS activist group, were arrested. CBS believes they entered the studio by using fake CBS IDs. ACT UP has staged many protests for more government funding against the disease, but this was the first time they managed to pull off such a live televised stunt.
We're sorry about that. I had a bit of an eruption here in the broadcast. We're going to take things right from the top. Saddam Hussein has...
The war is here.
An ACT UP spokesman defended the protest.
Is this a rather immature or silly way to bring your message across to try to help your cause?
No, we think that spending hundreds of billions of dollars bombing people in another continent is an immature and silly way to bring a cause to the televisions of this country.
Besides the CBS protesters, seven others were arrested at PBS for disrupting the McNeil-Lehr report. All were charged with trespassing.
This is not the first time the CBS Evening News has been disrupted by a protester. Once, when Walter Cronkite was anchoring, a studio guest streaked across camera. That incident prompted a clampdown in CBS security, which will no doubt follow in other stations across the city as a result of this ACT UP protest.
This is Channel 2 News at 11.
Tonight, some AIDS activists who opposed the war in the Persian Gulf tried to take their protest to a national audience by rushing onto the live set of the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. Now, it happened at 6:30 at the beginning of the broadcast, just as Rather was about to speak. They were chanting, "Fight AIDS, not Arabs." The newscast went dark for a moment. The protesters were removed, at which time Rather came back, and he apologized for the interruption. Three men were grabbed by CBS security tonight, and they are charged with trespassing. Other activists also made their way onto the studios of the PBS McNeil-Lehr report this evening, interrupting the beginning of the newscast.
Well, the reason I have not gone back to Mr. Maxwell in New York is that there has been a demonstration in our studio in New York where Robert McNeil and Mr. Maxwell were sitting, and we are unable to, at this point, to go back to Mr. Maxwell. As soon as whatever's going on up there has been cleared up, we will go back to New York and resume my conversation with Charles Maxwell as well as Mr. Zuckheim. Back to New York, and I want to ask Mr. Maxwell a question, but before I ask Mr. Maxwell a question, I want to ask Robin a question. Can you tell us what happened, sir?
Yes, it was a group of people who called themselves nonviolent demonstrators from the ACT UP AIDS group who complained that we and the media are spending too much time and attention on the war in the Middle East, which they say will never kill as many people as are dying of AIDS. And I told them that this program has spent a lot of time on the AIDS matter, and we'll continue to be interested in it, and we will be covering it more in the future.
Robin McNeil explaining to Jim Lehrer in a Washington studio, Robin McNeil in New York, what had happened that night, January 22nd, 1991, when AIDS activists came into their studio. They also occupied the studios of CBS Evening News that night. As we go on now to a tape interview that was done shortly after with John Weir, the activist who made his appearance on the CBS Evening News that night.
I think it was the day of desperation. There was a big ACT UP demonstration where we were all going to go into Grand Central Station and lie down in the middle of rush hour and block the terminal. And the night before, all of these affinity groups had planned to do these separate actions either during the day or the night before the action. And I got involved with this with Action Tours, and they had planned to try and invade all three television studios during the nightly news, as well as the PBS network, McNeil-Lehr report. And so my group had planned to take NBC News and CBS News and ABC. I guess we never got into ABC, and we never got into NBC, but we did get into the CBS Nightly News with Dan Rather. it was myself and Dale Peck, who's also a writer, and Daryl Bowman, and the three of us went into the studios way, way west on 57th Street, the CBS studios. And we walked down the hall. It was in the middle of the war in the Gulf. And there were all these people around. It was quite a mad scene. They'd even notice us walking in our business suits, trying to look like television executives. And we strolled down the hall with our fake IDs and stood by the side and waited for the show to start. And as soon as Dan Rather said, "Good evening," Dale and Daryl and I ran on the set and jumped in front of the camera. And what happened was that my face pops into the screen, into the lower left-hand side of the screen for about 3 seconds. I saw it later on video. Just John Weir's head going, "Eep!" And we were chanting, "Fight A's, not Arabs." And then the studio technicians came after us. There were like 15 men and burly men from Queens in blue parkas and wallabies, and they ran at us and grabbed us and hauled us off the set. And then they threw us in jail. And of course, I didn't see any of this at the time. I didn't find out until later that I'd actually been on the air. And I got home that night, and there were a whole list of a whole bunch of messages on my phone machine. All kinds of people saying, "Congratulations, John! You did a good job. We saw you in Dan Rather. It was great. That was your head. Yay! Go, go!" And there were two messages from my mother, and one from my father, and one from my brother. My mother said, "John, I can't believe you would do this to your father. I'm very upset with you. You don't know what this means to your father." Click. And my father, "John, this is your father. Call me tomorrow." Click. Then my brother, "Hey, John, what is it? You're turning into Larry Kramer or something?" And then my mother again, "John, I understand what you're trying to do, but I just don't think it's a good thing." Click. And it turns out that as a matter of fact, my father works for television. My father works for NBC TV, which is a rival network. I was on CBS. My father's job at NBC TV, he's retired now, but for 35 years, his job was basically to take care of all, he was basically the vice president of Cut to Black. When activists invade your studio, he was like in charge of technical foul-ups, and whenever anything went wrong, they called my father. So essentially, when I leaped in front of the TV camera, It was John leaping into Dad's TV studio and Dad pulling the plug. So he took it personally. And my mother's father ran a radio station in Denver. He was a manager of the radio station in Denver during the war. And my brother is a video editor. He edits for NBC Nightly News. He did at the time, and he edited at the Olympics in Barcelona and in Seoul in Korea, and he has Emmy Awards. And it was basically as if I had violated the family temple by running into this TV studio. And they were all very flipped out. And they had this family meeting where I was summoned. It happened to be my 31st birthday, in fact. And we met. They didn't take me anywhere fancy. They took me to a little diner in the bottom of the RCA building where my father works. This cheesy diner. And they sprang for a tuna fish sandwich. And the three of them sat there looking very grim. My father had all this identification around his neck, very thick, not his usual identification. And I said, "What's all that?" And he said, "This is because of you." And I said, "This is the John Weir Honorary Identification Badge now." And my mother said, "John, I know that it's important. You have to do what you feel, but I don't understand why you spit in the face of your entire family heritage." And and my brother was glum and grim. And then my mother said, "John, you grew up in the 60s. I live in the 60s. You know what it was like, this kind of activism? I mean, it didn't work for Jane Fonda, and it's not going to work for you." And that was really pretty much the last of our family encounter. Everyone went on their way, and then about a week later, my father summoned me to his office in the RCA building. He worked on the 26th floor, and I went there feeling like a pariah because I grew up around TV studios, and I knew exactly how I had offended him by invading his sanctuary. So I expected the guards to throw me out as soon as they saw me. But everyone was friendly and said hi. I went up to his office, and I sat down at his desk. And my father's sort of an imposing man, bald, about 40 pounds overweight. Has a very low resonant voice, which he dropped an octave to talk to me. He's reading the New York Times. And there was some article in the New York Times about as many people had died of AIDS as had died during the Vietnam War. And he's reading this, and he looks up and says, "Did your people plant this story?" And I said, "My people?" And then he showed me the article, and I said, "No, no, no." And he said, And he said, do you realize that Saddam Hussein probably saw that broadcast? This is still in the middle of the war. And I said, uh-huh. And he said, hmm. And then he said, well, you're a terrorist. Do you know that? And I said, oh, no, I guess I didn't really know that. And he lectured some more. And I don't have much of a rapport with my father. We don't really ever talk about very much. But it was clear that I had finally reached him, you know, for once in my life, because I'd communicated with him in the way he understood. I was on TV, and he could get that. And he got it, but it wasn't just that he got it. He kind of looked at me like, this is my son. He must have had a reason to do this. And we had a little discussion about that article in the Times and about how it's true that more people had died of AIDS than had died in Vietnam. And we talked for about, I don't know, half an hour. More conversation than I've had with my father probably in the last 10 years. And he finally got up from behind his desk. And he said, well, you know you're my son, don't you? And I said, yes. And then he embraced me. And I thought, he gets it. You know, and a lot of the time I think, I've been an intermittent AIDS activist. I haven't done a lot of work recently, and I was active for a while, but then I haven't been, and I have various kinds of despair about it, and I wonder what good that particular action did. Jumping in front of a TV camera seemed like, in some respect, I was just gratifying my own need to be angry with my father. But I did have a sense in the moment that he spoke to me that he understood, that it was the first time where he thought to himself, oh, he must have a reason for doing this. Oh, look, 50,000 people are dead. Huh, this must be a problem. And I guess I felt like that was the best that I could hope for. I thought, well, if I could just reach one person, and that person happens to be my father, then it's been worth it.
John Weir, longtime AIDS activist and author, describing his action at CBS Evening News in January of 1991. It was recorded by James Wensey of AIDS Community Television. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll speak to the CBS producer who gave them the floor plan for that night. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, that music, Bobby McFerrin's Common Threads about the AIDS quilt. Well, Ann Northrup is on the line with us right now, longtime member of ACT UP, former CBS producer, now a co-host of Gay USA on local television, cable TV in New York. So, Ann Northrup, how did they figure out how to reach Dan Rather's inner sanctum?
Well, it was simpler than you would expect, Amy, and good morning, and I'm glad you're still on the air. I hope you remain on the air doing the kind of stuff you do. I had been a CBS News producer from 82 to 87. I'd left then thinking that the entire operation was intellectually bankrupt. Ended up joining ACT UP, and in the beginning of 91, when the Gulf War was starting, some ACT UP members came to me and said, you used to work at CBS. What can you tell us about it? We want to interrupt the broadcast. And I said, well, it's really not that hard. The security is not tight, and the studio's very close to the front door. All you have to do is go in and flash something that looks like an ID card, go down this corridor, take a left, go into the studio, and you're right there. And if you're well-dressed enough, they won't say anything to you. And if they do, you can just pretend you're an ad salesman from headquarters. And they not only did they do it, they went in a week early on a dry run to make sure they could get into the studio. And as I had predicted, they got in perfectly easily. They'd taken my old CBS ID and copied it, but it wasn't even a question of having it closely examined. All they had to do was just flash it as they walked by the front desk. And sure enough, they got to within 10 feet of Dan Rather as he was doing the live broadcast, stood there and watched it, and then left. And then a week later, at the appointed time, they did the same thing. So they were standing right there, unchallenged, and when the broadcast began, they just ran out in front of the cameras.
And what did you think of the impact of their action that night as they chanted, "Fight AIDS, not Arabs"?
I thought it was fantastic, because what happened was that, as you showed with the coverage you just replayed, this interruption of the CBS Evening News was seen all over the world. CNN picked it up and ran it as a story. And I remember Jimmy Breslin, the well-known columnist and writer, telling me that he was in Israel at the time trying to cover the Gulf War, and he saw it on CNN there. So this did make an impact everywhere. And the whole point of all of these actions was to get AIDS in the news, to get it talked about, to get it recognized and looked at as an issue. Because what happens is that these issues that we care about and think are so important get ignored by the mainstream media. And what we have learned as activists is that we have to do things that will grab attention to get the issues covered. And our aim has always been not to be liked personally, because we don't expect that, but simply to do whatever we have to do to make sure the issues are covered. That's the point of these demonstrations.
Did Dan Rather ever figure out what you'd done?
Oh, yes. He, you know, I had been widely quoted as an ACT UP member over the years as a former CBS News producer. So it was pretty easy for them to put two and two together and figure out I'd been involved. I like to point out that it wasn't my idea, but nonetheless, Dan still to this day does not talk to me. The result internally at CBS was that they did change the whole security system there. I actually think they ought to thank us for that, because we were nonviolent and not a threat, and it was very easy to get in, and now it's harder, and it should be harder to get into those places. But I was on a plane with him a few years ago and tried to talk to him, and he refused to talk to me and ended up, in fact, cowering in a corner of the airport terminal to avoid me after we got off the plane.
I should say we tried to reach Dan Rather and Robin McNeil and Jim Lehrer to ask about their reactions 10 years later to what happened, but we were not able to get any of them. You were involved in a media action just in the last few days.
I was at Newsweek. This was not planned, but Newsweek, along with others, has been, and including what we're doing right now, has been noticing the 20th anniversary of the recognition of the AIDS epidemic, which actually has been going on a lot longer. And they held a forum to which they invited activists and journalists, a small panel, an interview by the editor of Newsweek with Larry Kramer and Dr. Seth Berkley, who's working on a vaccine. And they were having a rather useless discussion, I thought. So I got up and got angry at them and pointed out that I'm sick of all these articles about the medicine, which we've heard about 9 million times, and not about the politics. When is Newsweek, or anybody else for that matter, going to start talking about the fact that the Bush administration is suing Brazil to stop them from making their own versions of the drugs, is not giving enough money to stop the global epidemic, is constantly, on a daily basis, doing things that interfere with taking care of people who are sick all over the world. We just don't hear those stories. We don't hear that the pharmaceutical industry is the highest profit industry in the world and could easily be giving away these drugs on a much wider basis. And the Bush administration is supporting the pharmaceutical industry instead of holding them accountable. These are the kinds of stories we think should be done rather than on and on and on with the virus, which we have heard ad nauseum.
Very briefly, we're in the last segment going to have a debate between AIDS activists and one of the top officials at the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. But I want to quickly go through with you and other guests the actions over the years. ACT UP is known for some of the most effective and creative civil disobediences.
Yes. Starting with attacking Wall Street and the Stock Exchange at one of the very first demonstrations in 1987, going after the Food and Drug Administration in 88 to change the drug approval process, which we succeeded in doing, going after the National Institutes of Health about a year later to talk about their research processes, going after the school boards and AIDS education, going after Al Gore during his campaign to raise international issues. All along the way, we have actually, one of my favorite demonstrations was people going to some meeting and wearing clown masks to personify the idea that the officials speaking were clowns. We have been certainly iconoclastic. We do not defer to authority, and I think that's what has made us so effective. We are willing to speak the truth under any circumstances. And maybe our most famous demonstration, which I was part of, was going into St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York in December of 1989 and lying down in the central aisle in the middle of Mass to protest the fact that the Catholic Church in New York was controlling AIDS education in the public school system.
We're also joined in the studio by Eric Sawyer, one of the founders of ACT UP New York. Eric, why did you found ACT UP?
Well, we mainly were angry that not enough was being done to try to mount an effective response to the AIDS epidemic. Larry Kramer had found out that the national government had allocated more than $100 million to test AIDS drugs, and that almost none of that money was being spent because there was a hiring freeze at the National Institute of Health preventing the hiring of governmental researchers to oversee clinical trials, so only one drug, AZT, was being tried in patients, and there were a number of other drugs that were just languishing in the pipelines, not being tested at all because there were simply no governmental researchers to review the applications to test the drugs. And so he was outraged. It was another incident of the government claiming to be doing something and claiming to be spending money when it had no intention to see that the money it had allocated be spent. And so we basically hatched a strategy where he'd give a speech, he'd make it known that this money was going unspent, we'd call for no more business as usual for the government to drop the hiring freeze, to hire researchers to test the drugs, and for the drug companies to step up to the plate and spend their own money to test drugs.
Very quickly, an outline of a review of some of the actions that you most remembered and thought were most effective.
Well, Ann mentioned a number of the really widely known actions that got a lot of attention. There were some that were also quite creative that aren't quite as widely known, but I think demonstrated quite well our ability to use street theater to bring an issue to the forefront and also to demonstrate the need for an effective change, one of which is the Housing Committee, which I helped start, which became Housing Works, did, where we collected furniture that was put out on the sidewalk in New York City for garbage collection in my pickup truck, took it to the headquarters of housing preservation and development and set up apartments in the street during rush hour to protest the lack of housing for homeless people with AIDS, and by having sofas and discarded dishwashers, etc., in the middle of traffic during rush hour, we tied up traffic for hours, because not only did they have to bring the police to arrest us, a tow truck to tow my pickup truck away, but garbage trucks to collect the furniture, and we were able to tie up the city for long enough to get the media there during rush hour and primetime news, and brought to the public's attention the need for homeless housing. And within a month, the city announced a $25 million fund to create housing for homeless people with AIDS.
Julie Davids is on the line with us from Philadelphia, member of Philadelphia ACT UP since 1990. Your group in Philadelphia has staged some pretty incredible actions around presidents and presidential candidates. Could you go through some of them?
Through the years, ACT UP Philadelphia has grown in strength and diversity and increased our ability to effectively win change for people with HIV and those at risk. And one of the ways that we've done that is being pretty close to Washington, D.C. We regularly bring 10 to 12 busloads of primarily African-American people living with HIV and their loved ones to fill the streets and whenever possible to directly confront politicians who have power over things that affect their lives and affect the lives of people with HIV worldwide. It's often brought up in 1991 at a protest of a fundraiser for a Republican gubernatorial candidate where George Bush the first was there. We were attacked by the Philadelphia Police Department, and there was a out-of-suit federal civil rights settlement with a restraining order against the police for 5 years. So that's some way that we've been able to get a temporary measure of safety for activism in our city that's now a bit worn off. But over the we work closely with ACT UP New York and others over the last presidential campaign to focus on Gore, who had an actually direct role in trying to block access to affordable AIDS treatment in South Africa. And that gave us the ability to highlight the issue in the campaign when no one really thought, strangely, that AIDS was going to be an issue.
ACT UP around the country followed Gore with signs from the day he announced for president, right? Gore, greed, kills. But back to that police action. How did the police treat you 10 years ago?
10 years ago, they treated us poorly, and they treated us poorly last summer when we were the focus of crackdown within the events around the Republican National Convention. Even though we didn't have any large activities planned, the police continue, as many listeners know, to be mobilizable as tools of the state to crack down on effective activists. The fact that our group then was perceived to be largely queer, and now we are and are perceived to be largely queer and people of color, really removes the small measure of safety that others may have. We were a man was left bleeding from the head, who's a person with AIDS, for half an hour in the street. We weren't allowed to go near him. There was tons of injuries and a large settlement. But I think what's most important is that despite that, and despite the tremendous obstacles that people with HIV and their loved ones have faced, we've set a tone for activism in the United States and worldwide that says that people don't just have to lay down and die. And we continue to use really, really mundane techniques like filling busloads of people and spending hours making community presentations, because that's what it takes to win. And in the age of the Internet and all that, we still have to do really basic community organizing, because that's how we fight for our lives.
Julie Davids of ACT UP Philadelphia. Mary Lucy is with us from Los Angeles, a long-term survivor of AIDS politics and interim AIDS coordinator for the city of L.A. Can you talk about some of your actions very briefly before we go to break?
Good morning, Amy. Well, Nancy and I started getting involved in ACT UP in about 1989 after I was diagnosed, and I had done some time in the state penitentiary for women. And in the penitentiary, the infirmary was not licensed to treat people with medical conditions. And so we organized a protest in December of 90 to go out to the California Institute for Women. And at that time, they pulled up big trucks in front of the gates, and they locked down the yard, and we realized that we probably were off our mark. And I think about 100 people showed up for that action, and it did get some media attention, but we didn't expect the system to penalize the women inside. And so the next round, we took our action to their offices in Sacramento, and about 28 people were arrested, and we did take over their offices. And I must say, for a person who's been inside and then to walk into the administrative offices of the Department of Correction was a very scary situation. And of course, they were they had way too many guards for as many people as there were. And then we did a lot of World AIDS Days actions around women. We shut down one of the busiest intersections in the country, which is Federal and Wilshire, right in front of the Federal building in West L.A. And the police, and that was a women's action, and the police pretty much beat us pretty bad there. And then another great action from Los Angeles was the 91 Oscars, where we had these wonderful posters, because as you know, a lot of artists were involved in this movement, and we had a poster of Oscar with a condom over his head, and that got a lot of media attention, and a lot of people really enjoyed that. But the actions in Los Angeles started right after some of the larger actions in New York. People came back and started mobilizing, and LA County did not have a hospital or a clinic for people with AIDS, and so there were several demonstrations at the Board of Supervisors where people were arrested and tombstones were put out in front. And I think ACT UP camped out in tents for about 45 days at the county hospital, demanding that they structure a unit for people with AIDS in L.A. And so there's been constant actions over the years. They've calmed down quite a bit lately, but I can't say that there's been a whole lot of change those days either.
Mary Lucy, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll be joined by Phil Wilson, also of Los Angeles, founding director of the African American AIDS Policy and Training Institute at the University of Southern California, to ask how these actions around the country have affected organizing in the African American community. We're also going to be joined by one of the top officials of the Centers for Disease Control, Dr. Ron Valdeseri, to talk about how this activism affected science, AIDS science in the United States. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we look back at 20 years of AIDS activism, back to the time when the CDC first came out with a report that three men were dying of unknown illnesses. We are joined by Phil Wilson, founding director of the African American AIDS Policy and Training Institute, University of Southern California. You've been living with HIV for 21 years, full-blown AIDS for 10 years. How has this kind of AIDS activism, how have you been involved with it, and how in particular has it affected the black community?
Well, I think that black and brown communities obviously have reacted differently to the AIDS epidemic than the gay community has. Now, there are cultural differences in between the different communities. Certainly the work of ACT UP and other activists have raised awareness among all Americans. I think that for many black activists, what we've attempted to do is to focus first and foremost internally in our communities, to work with indigenous black organizations and black media and black churches and black elected officials in kind of to deal with the epidemic inside our community. Kind of the notion if you will, that black people have to respond to this disease for ourselves. And so with that, we've spent time working with black civil rights organizations and black elected officials. The Congressional Black Caucus has always been there in being supportive on AIDS issues. Over the years, it's been a slow and long process, but particularly most recently, we've been able to move black civil rights organizations to take up the issue of HIV and AIDS in a significant way, as well as being able to move black clergy and the faith community to deal with this epidemic in our communities. And that's actually why the African American AIDS Policy and Training Institute exists, to reduce HIV health disparities between African Americans and other racial ethnic groups by engaging black people and black organizations in efforts to combat AIDS.
Just a few days ago, we did a special segment of the program with African-American gay men looking at this population that is the fastest growing AIDS population in the country. How has that affected your work and what you do?
Well, you know, certainly, you know, the study that you're talking about, in February there was a study that was released that showed that AIDS prevalence among young black gay men is as high as 33%. Which means that one-third of all black, gay, and bisexual men or men who have sex with men under 30 now most likely are already HIV positive. To put that in context, that means that if you're young, black, and gay, and you live in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, you have a higher probability of already being HIV positive than if you live in the worst-hit parts of sub-Saharan Africa. Last week, now, there was an incidence report released that showed that incidence among young black gay men may be as high as 14.7%. Incidence is an indicator of when people were infected. Now, put simply, if you take 100 young black gay men under the age of 30, you start out the year with all of them being HIV negative. By the end of the year, 15 of them will be HIV positive. You extend that over 5 years, and you have 85% positivity rate. That's an epidemic of genocidal proportions. So what we're trying to do is to say that this is a disaster. The epidemic is not over, despite what some would have you believe, and we need to mobilize in ways like we have not ever mobilized before.
Dr. Ron Valdeseri is with us, Deputy Director of HIV Research at the Centers for Disease Control. You just came out with this report. What is the CDC, the government, doing about this?
Well, the CDC has been very concerned about increases in self-reports of unsafe behavior among men who have sex with men, whether or not they're gay-identified or not, outbreaks of a variety of sexually transmissible diseases, including syphilis and gonorrhea, and the possibility of an increase in HIV incidence. So we've been grappling with this issue actively for the last 24 months. We have taken a number of steps to date, and clearly we feel that much more needs to be done. We've alerted all state and local health departments and community-based organizations and national organizations with whom we have funding relationships, as well as other prevention partners, about these data. Again, even before the incidence data that Mr. Wilson referred to, as he suggested, there were prevalence data published earlier in the year, and we've been sharing this information. We have also done a satellite broadcast specifically on the issue of HIV prevention programs for men who have sex with men, and are in the process of developing a number of specific trainings. But much more needs to be done, and we're actively looking into that right now. We have a group internally working on this issue, as well as our National Advisory Committee recently met in Atlanta, and they were presented these data. They're very concerned about them, and have directed us to develop a specific action plan.
Mary Lucy, you've been long time involved with campaigns to change CDC definitions of AIDS, especially relating to women like yourself.
Yeah, I'd like to say that the CDC has been concerned for 20 years. You know, and I've looked at the strategic plan that's recently been released, you know, And it looks like a kitchen sink plan to me. I mean, there's 1,400 action steps that have been submitted. It seems like everything has been thrown into this plan, you know, and it, there's no strategy to it. There's no depth to it. And it's just kind of repeating history. And if you look at the Young Men's Study, which I think that those are great studies done, but there's important pieces that keep being just entirely overlooked. And if you break down the studies even more, you can see the women all through those studies, because about 30% of those men, like, and I'm, these are just estimates off the top of my head because I don't have the papers in front of me, about 20% of them reported being bisexual, and they were put into an MSM category, which I have never met a man who says, hi, I'm an MSM. You know, it's just a big pool. And then about
MSM means
men who have sex with men.
Means men who have sex with men.
That you know is a category that is not like that's not reflective of society, you know. But our programs are designed around this.
Eric Sawyer.
Hold on a second.
I'd like to ask the CDC when it's going to quit being concerned and stop doing research and take some action. Why aren't you pounding on the door of the White House and demanding that they force the networks, which reach everyone in America, to put ads on every single hour that educate people how to prevent them from spreading the disease, about the need to get tested, about the need for people to use condoms every time they have sex? I mean, everybody needs to know what steps are taken so that they don't infect other people, so that they themselves protect themselves from getting infected. And no mass public education program has ever been launched in this country to make sure that every American knows how to prevent the spread of HIV. And that's your job.
Ron Valdeser respond to
that.
Yeah,
if I might, and respond to that, and also to the woman who spoke about the strategic plan, that, public information is very important, but what I would say is even more important is targeted prevention that's targeted to the groups who are at risk and that is delivered in terms they can understand. Yes, we do use the term men who have sex with men in our scientific publications to encompass all the diverse sexual behaviors. I agree with the woman that is not on the street the kind of language or the term that we would use in our programs. And I would also point out that what we do have a responsibility to develop comprehensive approaches to all groups at risk for HIV. Obviously, the important dimension of it is with limited resources, we want to make sure that those public funds are directed not to everyone, but to the groups who are bearing the greatest burden. And as this new report shows, among the men who are being infected, in 1999, we released information showing that 60% of all men who become infected with HIV in this country are likely becoming infected as a result of male-to-male sexual contact. So this has been an important issue. It will continue to be an important issue. And I would like to see American society be more broadly mobilized on this issue. I agree with the gentleman who said that it's not just CDC. We don't allocate our own budget. I think what we're trying to do by releasing these kind of data are making sure the policymakers who have the responsibility of
Speaking of policymakers, I wanted to ask Phil Wilson, with the Bush administration, how things have changed for your community and for yourself as a person with AIDS.
Well, you know, I think that there are a number of conflicting messages coming out of the Bush administration. On the one hand, the administration is saying that they understand the importance of AIDS. Unfortunately, their actions does not reflect the impact of the epidemic is having in black communities and across the world. You know, for the first time in the 10 years of the Ryan White Care Act, there's flat funding for Ryan White at a time when there are increasing number of cases among black and brown people and among women and poor people. It's absolutely unacceptable that Ryan White Care Act, which is the primary source of HIV care in this country is flat funding. In essence, that means that's a decrease in funding because people are living longer, so they need care for a longer period of time, and because of inflation. Secondly, the issues in the developing world, particularly Africa, there's been a call for a global AIDS fund. That fund will require billions of dollars. The administration has made a proposal of $200 million. That's like going into a burning house with a teacup of warm, tepid water. It's not going to get the job done. We need to respond appropriately to the epidemic, and so far that is not happening. One of the things that I would like to say to your listeners is that certainly the CDC can do more and must do more, but I am more concerned about what we are doing and what your listeners can do. And the Kaiser Family Foundation just released a report yesterday saying that Americans are interested in our government taking appropriate action with HIV and AIDS. And as Americans, we need to communicate that to our government. We need to communicate that to the administration. We need to communicate that to our leaders. Now, to say that this is an important issue for us.
Mary Lucy, how about the state of research on women and AIDS?
Well,
you have about 30 seconds.
It's pitiful. We still don't know what the proper dosing for medication going into women's bodies. We still don't know exactly how women get infected, whether it's vaginally or anally.
Because women aren't studied.
They're not studied appropriately. I mean, we have two epidemiology studies in this country for women, which tells us we can count how many women are dying. But we still don't know how this disease acts in women's bodies, and we know there's a gender difference. And a point to make on that is that early on in the epidemic, the men had KS, the women did not. The women have been there since 1982, and there were five cases of women in 1982. And this changing face of AIDS, I keep hearing that the face has never changed in women. It has always been African-American women. It has always been Latinas, and it has always been Caucasian women from day one, from the first identity of these women. So, you know, I think the government has really truly committed genocide in populations that have been underserved, and particularly among women. They have totally dismissed this epidemic.
Ron Valdeseri of the CDC.
Well, I certainly don't agree with that. I would say that, and we've stated this in our strategic plan, that we feel that it's possible with adequate resources, let me underscore with adequate resources, to reduce by half the number of new infections occurring in this country. I think probably most of your listeners understand that CDC is the federal agency that's focused on prevention, and we're very concerned about issues related to treatment and care, and the linkage between prevention and treatment. Our agency doesn't deal directly with clinical trials related to treatment. But
on that note, we're going to have to wrap up.
Yeah, and I think Phil's point was really important. Every American needs to take a stand and let the government know AIDS is important and that the U.S. government has to do more. We need research and money.
Well, people can check on the website, www.webactive.com, to find everyone's contact information. Eric Sawyer of New York ACT UP, Phil Wilson, founding director of African American AIDS Policy and Training Institute, University of Southern California, Mary Lucy, interim AIDS coordinator for the city of Los Angeles. I want to thank you all for being with us. Democracy Now! Produced by Brad Simpson and Chris Abrams, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.